Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. St. Louisans have long pointed with pride to hometown actress Marsha Mason. She's accomplished a lot since her days at Nearings Hall and Webster University. She's won 2 Golden Globe Awards and 4 Academy Award nominations for such films as Cinderella Liberty, Only When I Laugh, Chapter 2, and The Goodbye Girl. She's had success on and off Broadway and on television. She still keeps busy at her craft and will be in town this weekend to lend some luster to a fundraiser to help the local Insight Theater and to help offer her own professional insight for interns associated with that theater. Marsha Mason joins us now by phone from New York City. And Marsha, I can't resist saying hello to the Goodbye Girl.
Well, hello.
It's so nice to have a chance to talk to you. Have you had a chance over the years to get back to St. Louis very much?
Not too much, but I look forward to coming back this weekend. It should be a lot of fun. So,
do you think it will still, in any sense, feel like home to you?
I've traveled so much and lived so many different places that wherever I am, I sort of feel at home. So probably yes.
What sort of memories do you have about your time here in St. Louis as a young lady?
Oh, well, I had an absolutely wonderful time at Nearings Hall and Webster College then, as it was known. And I have some of, my fondest memories at both schools and growing up in St. Louis. So I had a terrific time there and looked forward to going to New York to become an actress. And so here I am.
So here you are. When did you set your sights on that Marsha Mason, the one that would go to New York and become an actress?
It was my freshman year at Nearings Hall, and there was a production, I believe, of Babes in Toyland, and I volunteered my father to play a role, and I wound up as a jack-in-the-box, I think. And it was my first experience, and from the moment I jumped out of that box, I knew that's what I wanted to do. So that was it. And fortunately, the school had a wonderful speech and drama club, and there were opportunities to do one-act plays and to travel in the Midwest in a regional competition for plays with other schools. So it was really terrific. I had such a great education there, and then Webster was really wonderful. They had a vibrant drama department, even though it was a small women's college at the time, and I got an enormous amount of experience there. And then after I graduated, I went straight to New York.
I guess that experience was extraordinarily important because there are so many young men and women who go to New York to, quote, make it in the big time, who have so much less than you apparently did.
Yes, that's true. But, when you have, a kind of focus and a passion, and if you can withstand the rejection, you'll do okay. But it's not an easy business, for sure.
I wanted to get at some point in the interview. I think there are probably a lot of people who watch performers like yourself who do such a good job and it seems so effortless, think that, gee, this is probably pretty easy. What's so hard about it?
I think the hardest part is, you have to be very strong. Because when you audition, you can't help but take it personally. I remember once Bobby De Niro said he auditioned for everything and he didn't worry too much about being rejected because there were millions of reasons why they didn't pick him. But for me, you can't help but feel it that if you could have done it better, if you could have done it differently, if you could have done it, I don't know, upside down. And so you have to be very strong and be able to kind of have such complete confidence in yourself and what you want to do so that you can take the rejection.
You didn't start out as a success. You had to do other things in order to stay in New York and keep taking auditions. What were some of the things that you did?
Well, let's see. I worked for the New York Central Railroad as a clerk. I was a go-go dancer. I sold coats at a a department store. I worked as a waitress.
what a lot of people do before they become that overnight success, right?
Yes, exactly.
You're coming into town this weekend to work or play or both with an old friend, Maggie Ryan. She's the founder of the Insight Theater. And you're going to be talking to some young interns here, from what I understand.
I'm actually going to do a master class with some of their interns there, as well as, you know, answer questions. And then I will do a question and answer period after the performance on Sunday of Chapter 2 with the audience, and then attend a reception and a luncheon on that day as well. So just to help support Maggie and the theater there.
It sounds like it's going to be a busy day. Tell me something about what Marcia Mason tells students during a master class.
Well, the master class can be kind of different. I've taught it at Stanford University, and I've taught at Carnegie Mellon. And it depends on the abilities and the ages of the students. Usually what I do is take them through some exercises. I will often look at monologues that they're using for their audition pieces, for if they're in high school, for college, or if they're of graduate age, then, you know, what they might want to be using for an audition for a professional job. And if they do have scene work, I can often, you know, observe that and give notes for that as well. But I like sort of taking them through a series of exercises and then also answering questions that they may have, you know, personal questions about a career or a particular role or something like that.
How much of these things can actually be taught versus how much of it would have to be intuitive for someone to be successful?
Well, to be successful is one thing. To be talented is another. But I think that one has to learn a technique that is comfortable for them. They have to be able to call on their emotional life at the drop of a hat, and they have to be able to do it in a way that doesn't cost them, you know, their sanity. And also they need a certain level of just pure technique in terms of pacing and rhythm, understanding and how to break down a script or create an arc for a character. So there are a lot of different ways, obviously, to do that, and one can go to classes for that. As to talent or timing, those are kind of more ephemeral qualities, and some people just have them, and other people have to work hard to get them. But it doesn't necessarily mean that any of that's going to make you successful. That's sort of in the hands of luck and the universe. But and there are some people who are very lucky who may not be as talented as other people, and there may be some very talented people who just can't ever get a break, and that's just the nature of the world.
I was going to bring that up because you did draw a distinction between success and talent. And there are certainly people whose names are probably household names who fall into the more successful and talented category, but nonetheless, there they are.
That's right.
Right. Tell me a little something.
Or their talent can be small, but they know how to use it well, you know?
Or maybe reapply it in somewhat different direction. And that kind of brings me to Maggie Ryan. I don't know her, but from what I've been reading, you and she were on kind of the same plane at one point during your school days here. But you went in one direction and she went in the other, but both obviously in the same field.
Yes,
And she's done very well, but she's done it on a much more limited stage, if you will. No pun intended.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. How important is local theater?
Well, I think theater in general is important. First of all, it gives you an opportunity to experience feelings and emotions, get outside of yourself, put your day behind you, and delve into the world of another, you know, human being. And if the play is really good, then it will touch you in a way that you may learn something, you may get in touch with your own feelings in a way that can be very beneficial and helpful and cathartic. And on the other level, it can inform and educate you. So I think that the theater is absolutely necessary to being a human being. And I think that anybody who studies acting can apply those what they've learned in any number of fields. I don't think you necessarily, just because maybe a student starts out in the theater or the fine arts, doesn't mean they can't make those applications to being a diplomat, to being an advertising person, to running a company. It's not very different.
Can you tell, and you've been at this for a while, can you tell by just reading a script whether or not a play or a production is going to be a success?
No, you can't tell that. I think I can sort of glean if a play can be a good one, but it's ultimately in the hands of the director, the producer, and the actors. And how it's perceived that makes it a success.
We're talking with Marcia Mason. She is joining us from New York City. She's going to be in town this weekend for a fundraiser. I'll have more on that a little bit later. And we have some information concerning that on our website at stlpublicradio.org. Marcia, we're going to take a quick break. I'm going to invite listeners to come on in. There may be some people here that knew you way back when at Nearings or Webster.
Okay.
Hopefully a few of those folks will call in. But anyone is welcome. If you have questions or comments and you'd like to chat with Marcia Mason, you can do so at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. And we'll take a tweet at STL on air. Back in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back to our conversation with Marcia Mason, the actress, St. Louisan. As we indicated just before that break, she will be in town Sunday for a fundraiser to help the local Insight Theater. There will be a performance of Neil Simon's Chapter 2 at the theater at Nearings Hall, along with a talkback and a reception. We have more information on our website at stlpublicradio.org. I'd like to talk for a moment about Chapter 2, which will be the performance this weekend, Marcia. But first, we have a clip, just a short clip from the trailer from the movie Chapter 2. Let's listen to that.
Neil Simon's Chapter 2.
Hey, listen.
It's about good intentions.
George, trust me.
And strange combinations. It's about lasting relationships.
Who is it?
5 Minute Man.
And deep commitment.
Which one of you is Jenny?
Me!
James Caan and Marcia Mason in Neil Simon's Chapter 2, rated PG.
Bye-bye!
West Indies, please!
All right, and welcome back. Well, Marcia, does that bring back some memories?
Yes, thank you.
I wanted to play that just to give folks some sense of what's going to be going on this weekend with the stage version of that. That, of course, was in a sense biographical. Your former husband, Neil Simon, wrote that about your early relationship. And I'm just wondering, you know, how difficult it would be for an actress to play a role about herself, essentially, in a major film?
I suppose in some ways it would be very difficult, but you see, the movie was done about, I guess, around 4 years after the play. I didn't do the play, so by the time we were ready to do the movie, I felt very different and more separated from that early character. And also, because the material was written from Neil's point of view, it really wasn't as personal or revelatory, with the exception of some scenes that were kind of literally out of real life. But then in those scenes, I understood what was really happening, both to myself and to the male character. So it was actually pretty easy to strike the right tone of the piece.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I think that's sort of, I can't think of anything else really. It seems a little odd, but it was kind of very separate. And I don't know, I think I've always been able to kind of separate myself out from a situation enough to be able to make informed decisions or professional decisions. And I was always like that. Both Neil and I had enormous respect for each other's work. And so we were able to work together really, really well, whereas a lot of married couples can't, because I guess the personal comes into it too much. But for us, it was kind of the opposite. We had a really strong professional working relationship that was mutually respected and respectful. So we did some really great work together.
Oh, you certainly did. You never had any misgivings then about your personal story, either on the stage version or later?
No, because I think I also wanted it to be as close to what I felt was right, you know? And that would have been kind of hard. But at the same time, I was willing to let it go if they thought it was best for somebody else to do it.
You two were married during an incredibly successful portion of both of your careers. I think you were married at a time when he had 4 hit shows on Broadway at the same time. Is that so?
Yes, I think so. Uh-huh.
I can't imagine what it must be like to bask in that kind of success. I think that was unprecedented then and still is.
Yeah. He was so loved by the New York audiences, and he just had his finger on the pulse of that community so well with his plays. And they were heartfelt and smart and very funny and touching. And it really struck a chord with people. So his success was clear, you know, and very obvious. And he was, you know, truly loved by many people. So that part is really kind of spectacular.
I wonder if that love is part of the engine that drove him, because he was extraordinarily prolific as well.
Well, he was always that way. He wrote every day. And he just had a wonderful work ethic that was inculcated in him, you know, from the get-go when he was first starting out. And he loved it. So he wrote every single day, and he would have a whole drawer full of scenes or ideas. And after breakfast and reading the paper, he'd go to his office and pull them out and begin work on them. And sometimes he showed them to me. Sometimes he would wait. Sometimes he would show me whole acts, sometimes scenes. And then some he kind of didn't feel, you know, he would put them away again and then take them out a year later.
Such a life.
Uh-huh.
So it's to be admired by so many. We have, speaking of people who are admired, as you are, we have some folks on the line I think want to reminisce a little bit. So let's give them a chance. We'll start with Ted calling from St. Louis. Ted, go ahead. You're on the air with Marcia Mason. Ted, are you there?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
I'm sure you don't remember me, but back in the days when we were designing the Loretta Hilton, you did a series of plays where we tested the stage out on the lawn. And it remains one of the great summers of my life because I got to watch you every night.
Oh, thank you.
And there was no doubt about stardom there. But it was also great fun, and it proved to be a very profitable summer because we changed the stage and made it much more flexible. I've often wondered, do you know whatever happened to the fellow who co-starred with you in many of the shows? A Greek guy. I remember him as being quite good, too, and he kind of disappeared from the radar, as far as I know.
No, unfortunately, I don't remember. Puts me in a bad spot, I know.
No, I don't mean to do that. But
No, that's okay.
Yeah.
No, I don't.
Anyway, it's great to have you back in town, and it was a fun summer.
Oh, thank you so much. That was one of my fondest memories. Thank you.
Bye.
Ted, thank you so much for the call. Let's take another one. Bob joins us from Chesterfield. Bob, thanks for waiting. Go ahead.
Hi. I didn't graduate. My wife graduated with Marcia from Webster College. And upon the completion of the Loretta Hilton, they presented a play called Stop the World, I Want to Get Off, which she starred with, as I remember, an all-star cast. Just wanted to thank you for that. My late wife really enjoyed it.
Oh, that's so lovely. Thank you very much. It was thrilling to be sort of a part of the whole impetus to create the Loretta Hilton. And in my senior year, I met Mr. Hilton, and he was terrific. And it just is wonderful to know that the theater has gotten bigger and better and more well-known and everything since those early days. I'm very, very proud to have been a small part of it.
Yes, as I remember, Mr. Hilton was there for the performance. It was sort of the dedication of the theater that night.
I think so, too, yes.
So, nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you, too, Bob.
Bob, thanks for the call. Yeah, theater is very, very healthy here in St. Louis, and I think a lot of people would probably point to you and certainly some others for having given the inspiration not only to do productions in town but to get into the business overall, whether it be behind the scenes or on the stage. So I'm sure you feel very good about that. I have an email here from Mary Mischenfelder. I am the niece of Marita Woodruff, who is an instructor with Marcia Mason at Webster University in theater. Over the years, I've heard many wonderful things about Marita's theater training at Webster, and her eyes would always light up and her smile grow even greater when she spoke of Ms. Mason. My question, does Ms. Mason remember any particular aha moment at Webster University when she felt a true difference had been made in the level of theatrical performance?
Well, first of all, Marita was an astounding teacher, and she, for whatever the reason, took me under her wing and really helped me to be able to break open both emotionally and to give me very strong, simple technique skills that served me in good stead for years afterwards. And I think that also, too, because I was able to work so much during my 4 years, I mean, I did Greek drama, I did musicals, I did comedy, I did Irish plays. We did all different kinds of material. And it was Marita who really led us in that direction, along with Wayne Louie. So I think the whole 4 years were the biggest aha I could possibly have had, really.
It's nice to be able to point back to some of those folks who helped along the way who sometimes don't get the credit that they deserve.
Oh, Marita and Wayne were amazing. And there was also another gentleman, Paul, who was one of the early teachers there. And they were just sensational. They really opened us up and gave us opportunities to do all different kinds of material, which really was invaluable.
You spoke earlier, Marcia, about the decision-making process that actors and actresses go through. One of the decisions you made was not to take the part of Norma Rae. You look, of course, Sally Field won an Oscar for that. Do you look back at that and say, "Oh shucks," and stamp your feet or anything?
Well, you know, that was where was a moment when life and a professional career for a woman comes into conflict, because I would have had to go away for 8 to 10 weeks. And at that time, I had 2 stepdaughters and Neil to take care of, and I had made a commitment to that relationship and that family. So it was just one of those things where you have to make a decision. And, you know, there's not much you can do about it. But I made a commitment to the girls, and I wanted to be there for them. They had lost their mother. She died early of cancer. And so I thought that was very important.
You know, we've talked a lot about the early days of Marsha Mason, but you've really developed in recent years a whole new audience, largely through the medium of television. I know you've done the Seinfeld show, you've done others, Frasier, and you've done things that are appealing to people even today in reruns who probably didn't know who Marsha Mason was before they saw those programs. It's a whole new world for you.
Yes, I mean, thank God for cable, because with cable, the movies had a second and third generational life, you know, like The Goodbye Girl and even Max Dugan Returns and some of the other movies, and Drop Dead Fred, for example. I mean, there were kids who are grown who saw it, you know, when they were 7 and 8. So, yeah, television was really wonderful. And then doing a show like The Middle on ABC, mm-hmm. a recurring role, it's kind of you keep your face out there a little bit, and it helps for people to remember you. And then maybe so when you're in a play or a movie or on television, they'll watch because they've enjoyed something from the past.
I hope I'm not being indelicate in bringing this up, but I think it's well established that it perhaps is more difficult for women of a certain age to continue working in any of the media that we're talking about here than it is for men. Has that been
totally
a difficult problem for you?
Oh, yeah. It's very frustrating, and it's painful at times. I think it's gotten a bit better, but no, it is very difficult. Men just have a longer shelf life in the business. And you just can see it. There are just more roles for men, and it's okay for them to age, whereas for women, that's not so the case. It started in the 80s when things, you know, when the whole sort of youth market opened up. But it's very difficult for women. There's no question about it. It's also gotten difficult, period, I think, for young actors, because in the 70s and early 80s, when I was working in all those films, we had an opportunity to do films, to learn our craft, and there wasn't so much a success or failure rate that was put on you, the competition and all that. Whereas now, if a young actor doesn't have a breakout movie within a 2 or 3 year period, they pretty much don't have a career, with, you know, some exceptions, obviously. But it is. It's very competitive, and it's very tough for women.
What about the writing today? We're, of course, familiar and talked about your former husband, Neil Simon, but working on programs like Seinfeld and Frasier, pretty darn well written. And do you think the writing is getting better these days or not?
I think the writing is excellent in cable, specifically. If you look at Homeland and some of the shows that are on cable now, the writing and the character development is really terrific. Then there are some wonderful shows on the networks, like The Good Wife and things like that. But the business itself, the broadcasting business and the requirement of advertisers and the general paradigm, if you will, that they're using, I think, doesn't necessarily always lend itself to good writing because of the constraints that are placed on the shows in terms of advertising time and how quickly they have to do it and the quick numbers, so a show can't really find its audience. If you remember Seinfeld, started in the summer, which was an unheard of idea, and it slowly built its audience. Whereas nowadays, if a show doesn't get a decent number, and those numbers are generally dwindling anyway, if they don't get their numbers right away, then generally speaking, the networks will yank them. So it's a much more cut and dry business in a way.
It's folks can always go to Netflix, and apparently they are.
Yes, yes.
Changing it.
Sure.
That's changing the whole dynamic as well.
Yes, right.
Now, I understand.
House of Cards is another perfect example too of a really first-rate show that's, you know, not on a network show broadcast.
Which one? I missed that. Which one?
House of Cards with Kevin Spacey.
Yes.
Excellent show.
Yes.
Yeah.
And now
you can get it on Netflix. Yeah.
Yeah, and that that was quite successful, as I understand. And you, as I understand, have a project with Gina Davis that hangs in abeyance as a possibility for a cable show.
Yes, I did a pilot. Is that what you're referring
yeah.
to? Yeah, for TNT. So they've turned it into TNT. I just heard yesterday. So we'll see if TNT decides to take it or not. You never know. So.
Can you give us this?
Hopefully.
So, can you give us some sense, if you would, of what this is all about?
Well, it stars Gina Davis, and she's just terrific in the show, and two wonderful men. And she plays a bounty hunter, bail bonds person. And she is a very 21st century woman, if you will. She's very physical and goes after the bad guys, and as her mother, I have a strong opinion about what she does and doesn't do. She has a teenage daughter and a divorced husband who still loves her, and I think it's a really interesting show, and the writing is quirky and I think very good by Amy Berg, so my fingers are crossed that TNT will like it.
Well, we'll keep looking for it, Marcia Mason. I have to take another break. Good luck with that, and we'll come back and continue our conversation and, again, talk to some of the listeners who might want to chat with you. 382-8255 is the number. That's 382-TALK. Send us a tweet at STL on Air or reach us through Facebook. We'll be back in just a moment with Marcia Mason. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back as we continue our conversation with Marcia Mason. I want to go right to the phones, Marcia. Martin's been waiting for a bit and I want to get him on the air. So, Martin, go ahead and chat with Marcia Mason.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. It's an honor to talk to you, Ms. Mason, and Don, as usual.
Thank you, Martin.
Well, I just got the rights to direct and produce Rumors by Neil Simon, which is one of my favorites. And you also talked about the difference in writing. And I find that writing back in the day was a little bit more intense. And even the comedy, the humor kind of comes out a little bit better. That was just a comment I wanted to make. But my question is, in St. Louis, we don't have a very good theater following, especially for when you're trying to start. This is only my fourth production. And I was wondering if you had any advice on how to excite the, you know, the theater audience, or to kind of try and motivate people to go to watch plays. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Well, I think that you have to have a strong mission statement as to what you want your little theater company to do, and then try to feel out what your target audience is, and and then, you know, everything is marketing now, so you do have to get your information out. And the Internet is always a good way. But even on a local basis, I think you could, you know, put out flyers, which I'm sure you probably already do, and word of mouth, and make a real sort of guerrilla-type game of it, you know what I mean, to get people to come. I think a lot of it has to do with how you sell yourself and the company and what it has to offer the community. I hope that helps a little bit.
It's kind of like writing a book. Writing a book actually turns out to be easier than selling it and marketing it, because it takes an awful lot of energy. Awful lot of energy.
That's right, yeah. And it is hard because everybody's attention span is a lot shorter now. But I think that if you can think outside the box and find more creative ways to bring it into the neighborhoods, even if you did street theater, for example, or in a park, especially in the summer, and then hand out flyers and stuff so that people start to become familiar with your name and the kind of work you're doing.
Enlist some volunteers. That doesn't hurt. Let's go back to Webster Groves and bring in Sarah. Sarah, thanks for waiting. You're on the air with Marcia Mason.
Hello, Miss Mason. Welcome back to St. Louis this weekend.
Thank you.
I'm curious about directors that you've worked with and what they may have done in your process to really help you with your craft. If there's any stories you have about those, I'm just curious about the director-actor relationship.
Well, I've been very fortunate. I've had wonderful directors. I've had a few clinkers, too, but overall, I've had some very good directors. And I remember early on, one of my earliest directors, Glenn Jordan, we did a series together, in the early 70s, 1970 or something. And he said to me, and actually we had worked together, I think, at the Eugene O'Neill Playwriting Conference in the late 60s. And he said something very important to me one time. He said, you know, don't you cry, you make them cry, meaning the audience. And I never forgot that, because that's a very important thing. You know, there's another famous phrase that I think that's in some of the acting books I've read over the years, but it says, if crying were acting, my Aunt Rivka would be Dusa, meaning, you know, if you cry, you know, everybody thinks, oh, gosh, isn't she good emoting like that? But the real key is to be able to hold it back with your technique, and so that the audience has the experience of their emotion. That was one thing. Marita taught me a great deal in directing me at Webster. And she taught me an age-old technique of what they call topping. In other words, you build a scene based on the dialogue, and you top each other. And you don't necessarily have to do it on an emotional level. It's purely a technique level of simply coming in a note higher. John Gielgud was famous for his monologues in Shakespeare and some of the sonnets and the Seven Ages of Man by actually somebody notated in music tones the differences. And so you have to be aware of rhythm and musicality in language. And then I think the next important person that I had Paul Mazursky in Blumenlove and Mark Rydell and in Cinderella Liberty. And because they were both actors, they had the facility and the vocabulary to speak to an actor. Some directors nowadays, especially if they're coming out of film school and they're young and inexperienced, they don't really know how to talk to the actor to get what it is that they want from the scene. And that's a very important thing for a director to be able to have. And the other part is to know when not to talk, you know. Herb Ross was wonderful that way when we did The Goodbye Girl and also, I can't remember the other show that we did. But he was there because he had started out as a dancer. He understood rhythm very well. And so we were able to have the comedy and the reality and the truthfulness of the character so that in The Goodbye Girl, it was funny, but it was also touching and it was real. And he let Richard and I have the freedom to explore the various scenes. We had a great time in the bathroom scene, for example. And Richard's rhythms were so terrific, and I was a great foil for him, I think. And then later in London, we did Prisoner of Second Avenue together and to great success because we had that terrific chemistry. So sometimes the director can be so important, especially in terms of the casting and putting the right people together to create that chemistry.
You worked with a fellow who went on to become a pretty good director. The gentleman's name is Clint Eastwood. That was in Heartbreak Ridge. He did not direct that, did he? That was before his directing days, wasn't it?
No. He directed me in Heartbreak Ridge.
Oh, he did?
And, yes, and what was interesting about Clint is that he acted in it as well. Mm-hmm. And there was a scene in the movie where we were on a dance floor, and they used a mobile camera, and Clint was moving me around the dance floor and had dialogue. And he was moving me in certain kinds of ways. And when the take was finished, I said to him, what were you doing? He said, oh, I was watching the light play across your face. I wanted to make sure that you looked right, you know, in the scene. So here he was dancing, acting, and directing all at the same time. He's a pretty amazing guy. He's really quite wonderful.
You said that it's handy for actors to be directors because they know how to talk to other actors. How about the acting itself? Does having been an actor make you a better director because of the acting part of it?
Not necessarily. I think every actor should direct once, every director should act once, and we should all write once because you gain a kind of respect for that craft that you may not have prior to doing it. And I learned that as a director. Some actors who have directed don't like it because what happens is they have an idea of how the scene should be played and they can't allow the actor to do it their own way because they get stuck. I think it was Carl Malden who said that. He was directing a scene and he said, I'm not a good director because I kept wanting to step in and act it. And you can't do that as a director.
One question you may choose not to answer, but while we have Clint Eastwood on our mind, did you catch his performance at the Republican convention? And would you care to comment on it?
You know, I didn't see it. I only saw all the flap afterwards, so I can't really... I think he's got a great sense of humor, and I think probably he just, you know, thought it would be interesting, and, you know, it didn't go over as well as I suppose he had hoped.
Well, I guess if the line is, I don't care what you say about me, as long as you mention my name, if you think of it in those terms, you got plenty of mention for it. Let's go back to the phones, Marcia Mason. Sheila's been waiting patiently, and Sheila, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello, Marcia. It's Sheila Sisko. I worked with you on The Cheap Detective.
Oh, hi.
Hi, and I've emailed you over the years, and I'm so humbled you're coming to St. Louis. I just found out, and I hope to be in your master class and at everything that you're doing. You are truly the most extraordinary actress, but you're also the most extraordinary human being, and you're self-conscious and caring and kind and incredibly talented, clearly. And St. Louis is a very, very special place that you're from here. And you're coming back. So I called. I hope to be in your class.
Oh, I hope so, too.
Really,
yeah,
will be
call Maggie and tell her to let you come in, that we had this conversation. And, you know, come into the class or, you know, come to the show in the Q&A and let me know where you are in the audience.
I will be at everything. And like I said,
okay.
I was this little actress on The Cheap Detective with all these great actors, so many actors of that. But no one in my whole career has ever been as kind and caring as you.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. That's
and
very
I
sweet.
So look forward to seeing you.
Well, I look forward to seeing you.
Sheila, thank you so much for the call. Let's bring in Tina now, calling from Chesterfield.
Hi, Ms. Mason. My name's Tina, and as you said, I'm from St. Louis. I just wanted to let you know The Goodbye Girl happens to be one of my favorite all-time movies. I love
how
strong you became. You know, you were just such a strong woman. I just love the movie, and I can pull it out and put it in and watch it. And every time it comes on TV, I don't care what I'm doing, I have to stop and watch it. It's just such a great movie, and you were so good in it. And I really just wanted to tell you I so much, you know, enjoyed that performance.
Oh, thank you so much. And I'm so grateful that the movie holds up enough, you know, and it doesn't seem too dated and everything.
it does seem to, I think, strike a chord, especially among women and their mothers. So that's just lovely to hear. Thank you.
Richard Dreyfuss is so good in that. How was it working with him in that?
Oh, he's terrific. He's just terrific. We just had immediate chemistry the moment we met, and it just continued through the movie. And every time we see each other over the years, we still have that same spark. So it's really nice.
Tina, we thank you for the call. Marcia Mason, how did you avoid having a spot on The Office, that wonderfully successful NBC series? I mean, Jenna Fischer is from St. Louis. I think she went to Nearings.
Oh, wow.
We had others. Phyllis Smith is from St. Louis. She's on the series, I think, from day one. Ellie Kemper is from Kansas City, but she has St. Louis and Missouri connections. You're like the only Missourian who wasn't on The Office.
I had no idea. I'm so sorry because I loved that show.
Yeah, that was really a good one, and they all have done a fine job over the years on that. I understand you're relocating to New York City.
Yes, hopefully once the farm sells in New Mexico, I'm going to move back east.
We haven't talked about the farm. That was kind of a departure. It kind of popped up at me when I was reading about you. I didn't realize you had spent so many years at that sort of organic farming work.
Yes. I moved there in 93, and I didn't know I was going to become a farmer. I just bought some raw land, and one thing led to another. And so I've been farming that land, and we're certified organic, and I was a New Mexico Organic Commodities Commissioner and all kinds of things. So
it was great.
It was terrific.
Did you learn anything on the farm that was helpful to your profession?
I think so, in the sense that, you know, prior to that, pretty much my identity was wrapped up in being an actor. And so if I wasn't working, my identity was a little fragile because I had wrapped it up so much in being an actress. When I moved to New Mexico, part of my healing, if you will, was to, you know, have a bigger life than just the work, because the work wasn't coming as much from what we were talking about earlier, because the business had changed dramatically, and I had to find a way to be comfortable with who I am. So I wound up over the years becoming an entrepreneur. I have a bath and body line and a wellness spray line from the medicinals. And I had to become a manager of Hispanic men who work on the farm. And I had to become a businesswoman on my own after the divorce. So all of those new roads, if you will, I think ultimately inform my me. And so I bring a bigger awareness, consciousness, experience to the material that I work on now than I did before.
We have just about a minute left. You wrote a memoir, autobiography, some 10, 12 years ago. When there was still plenty of time left, Marcia Mason, to continue the story. You're going to have to write a sequel.
I'm going to have to write another one.
What compels someone to write a memoir when life is still so active?
I don't know, excepting that my friend Shirley MacLaine said to me one day, she said, you know, it'll be the most important thing you ever do. And she was right. I really encourage, when I went on the book tour and everything, and when I give talk to people, it's really important to write your story, because everybody is an original, even if they don't think they are. And nobody really has to ever read it. Somehow writing your story down helps lift the baggage that we sometimes carry that weighs us down. And I found that I remember very distinctly when I went to New York, I had turned in the first draft. So I learned that was a really important thing to do. Write your story.
I hope there are many chapters yet to be played out for Marcia Mason. We look forward to seeing you here over the weekend. And thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for such a wonderful time.
Continued success. Tomorrow we'll talk with Director of STL 250, the organization planning next year's celebration of the city's 250th anniversary. We'll also talk with the new interim director of the Missouri History Museum. St. Louis on the Air, a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.